The documentary filmmaker has for her canvas the broad sweep of human experience. This week's guest has turned her lens on issues as diverse as AIDS patients in Africa and polluted air in an office building. She's Kendall Moore this week on Story in the Public Square. Welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. We do that each week by sitting down with storytellers and scholars and listening to their insights about the narratives that surround us. This week, we're joined by a remarkably talented documentary filmmaker, Kendall Moore, who is also a member of the faculty at the University of Rhode Island. Kendall, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So earlier in your career, you were a broadcast journalist. Mm-hmm. When you came to the academy and became a documentary filmmaker, you focused on medical and health issues, race and environmental issues. Mm-hmm. What drew you to that palette?
Well, it was personal. I'm attracted to the issue of race. For obvious reasons, I'm a black woman. I'm a descendant of slaves. I was raised in a household that was very committed to issues of injustice, racial injustice. So issues in that area, I've always been drawn to for obvious reasons. So it's been personal and also something that was sort of groomed in my household.
And do those themes permeate throughout your work?
Absolutely. If you look at the body of my work, you'll see that there's films that focus solely on race, and you'll see films that focus on the environment, and then you'll see films that are at the intersection of the two, so race and the environment.
So racial disparities, though, is a theme underlying really all of your documentary filmmaking.
Absolutely.
In one way or another. Mm-hmm. How did you come to that? I mean, clearly your background was instrumental, but you've brought that to your filmmaking. Why is that an important, larger story to tell?
Well, I feel like I have a responsibility to tell stories about racial injustice. As a filmmaker, I use film because it's a language that communicates across all boundaries, race, class, gender. I do this because I feel like I'm in a position to do it. I know the power of film. And so I do it in the classroom, and I also do it beyond the classroom. And it's just been something that I feel like I use my privilege, having these skills, this ability to communicate, in a way to affect change.
So you deal with a lot of young people, obviously. Mm-hmm. When they come to you, meaning when you first see them or when they first enroll in a class or you just encounter them on campus, are they aware, and this is a general question, of the racial disparities that underlie your work? I mean, obviously some are and some aren't, but in general, what can you say to that in terms of young people?
Well, the students that come to me don't know about my work unless they've Googled me, and usually they're not interested in my work. They're interested in whether or not I'm a hard teacher or an easy teacher. That's what they care about.
That's pretty much true for you.
They don't know anything about my work until they get into the classroom with me, and then they start working on these things. But in general, they don't know about me, and in general, they don't know much about racial injustice at all. The majority of my students are white middle-class students, a lot of them from Rhode Island. And this is the first time, A, they've had a black professor, and B, making films about racial issues. So it comes as sort of like a wake-up call to them. And usually after they leave my class, they become, let's say, woke-ish. I'm going to get in trouble for saying woke. I'm too old for that. But they do.
And with a lot some of them, greater understanding.
Absolutely. And a lot of times they leave, they graduate, and they come in, they're like, I want to do sports reporting only. And then they leave my class, graduate, and they evolve, and they become really interested in these issues. And gender issues, too, and issues of LGBTQ. I mean, it just broadens their horizon in ways that I think they didn't expect to when they first came into
the
classroom.
Well, that's part of the role of the academy.
It's the joy of being an educator.
Yeah.
Why did you, what drew you to documentary filmmaking as opposed to all the other different ways that you could tell a story in a visual media?
I think it started at a very young age. I was a Girl Scout who was given a camera at 8 years old, and I was taught how to take pictures, and then my parents set up a dark room, and it just sort of evolved from there. My parents always encouraged this, and I really enjoyed the fact that it was a medium that allowed me to be who I am. I'm insatiable, like I am the most curious. My parents would call it nosy, but I'm a very curious individual. Somebody called me nosy last week, actually, and I said, "Yay! I'm a professional nosy person." So. I basically had to find the career that matched my personality, and it hasn't changed. I'm just an endless well of question, looking for answers. So it was first being trained in the technology that evolved into the, you know, the camera stuff, and then also just being the person that I am, curious, nosy.
So you must have a love of the process,
love
though,
it.
Too. Going back to that 8-year-old girl, may I ask what kind of camera it was? Because I'm a camera geek. I'm sorry, do you remember what kind?
I think it was, maybe it was a Canon, or maybe in the early years, maybe a Brownie. I mean, it was a really
It
was a still camera.
With actual
lenses, and
film.
I had a fisheye lens, and yeah. The whole thing. Yeah.
So that just captivated you as a...
I was hooked from a young age.
And so you was telling stories. There's early storytelling in your life, right?
I was telling stories.
Picture tells a story.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, let's talk about some of the stories that you have told. So Song in the Crisis is about the scourge of HIV and AIDS among black women.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the genesis of that film and what you were trying to accomplish.
It's really funny. So I was living in Manhattan at the time, and I think I was getting a little bit of wanderlust. I wanted to break out. I was working for ABC News at the time, and George Bush was becoming our president, and I was getting a little bit anxious about working for conglomerate media under an administration that I didn't entirely support. I applied for a Fulbright. I got it. I ended up going to Tanzania. But I had worked for a year researching the AIDS epidemic in Africa, which was just, you know, the headline story for years and years and years. And I said, I really want to play some kind of role in communicating this information back to the United States. So that's what I did. I went to Tanzania for the year, and I reported on the AIDS epidemic. And I worked as a professor at the university there. I involved my students in reporting on the AIDS epidemic. So I was fully and entirely engrossed in HIV/AIDS while I was there.
So how did you get these people to open up about what for many was a very taboo subject? I mean, the woman that you documented.
Mm-hmm. So that's sometimes a mystery to me as to why people open up. Trust is, I think, a little bit magic and a little bit something else. It depends on what their agenda is, too. And I happen to be meeting people who felt like they didn't have anything to lose by sharing their story. It is a taboo subject, and for women in particular, you run the risk of revealing your HIV status. You could potentially be, beaten in the streets, right?
Wow.
So for somebody to reveal their status by putting their story on camera, that's taking a real risk. So a lot of the people I was working with were putting their lives on the line to do this. So I felt like I had to fully protect their story, which vis-a-vis was protecting their lives. And so that was a real commitment on my part and a commitment. We were in it together. But for them to do it, I think it was because ultimately they felt like by sharing their story, they would be helping other women. And I think that's ultimately why they were willing
to
be involved.
Does that responsibility scare you? Scare is probably not the right word, but that's a big responsibility.
It's a huge responsibility that I take very seriously. I took it seriously then, I take it seriously today. It almost moved me to tears to know the level of trust that people have given me over the years. So yes, it's upsetting, but I think the more important thing is now what can I do with this information and how can I do things to change policy or change culture to make lives better for these individuals.
So, I want to move on to another one of your films, the 2006 Sovereign Nation, Sovereign Neighbor, which spotlights Narragansett Native Americans. They live here in southern New England, and tensions between that tribe and those people and state government.
Yeah.
It's a very frank discussion. It's a dramatic film. And so let's take a look and a listen to some of that.
We're a nation within a nation. You know, we have that. We have our own bylaws. We have our own police department. We have our own community. And it's tough to live in society with you being a nation within a nation.
It's beyond reach for them to accept that there can be a sovereign nation that predated the history of the country and the establishment of this little state of Rhode Island and Providence Plantations. That how can this entity exist as a government when it's just a bunch of folks of color? And in Rhode Island, they'd say, and half of you don't look like natives anyhow. So there's this real disconnect, kind of psychologically. That's kind of the nice version. The not nice version is that it's just flat out racism.
To have these people come down here with dogs, it looks like something out of Mississippi in the damn 60s. The hell's the matter with these people? There's kids in here. He's
chief,
a minor. There's kids.
I would die for my tribe, chief.
I'm sorry, what are you saying there?
I will tell him.
Sovereignty means that we can live our life to the best of our ability, sharing and doing for one another without putting a burden on anyone else.
So you shot this in southern New England, but this film could have been shot in many parts of this country, Standing Rock, from coast to coast. The issues in that film are issues facing indigenous peoples today and historically. And is that really the largest story of that movie?
I think so. I think there's no question that the United States has failed indigenous communities, First Nations people. And I think that we have a lot of work to do. And that film, interestingly, I wouldn't have made that film unless I was trying to understand the culture of southern New England. So I did some research on, you know, what is Rhode Island like? I was coming from Manhattan. I had no idea. I'd only been here once. So I Googled it, and the first thing that came up was the smoke shop raid. And to my horror, to see people who look exactly like me, who I essentially consider to be kin, I was moving to that neighborhood. I thought, wow, Rhode Island, I didn't realize Rhode Island mistreated their indigenous people.
And it was brutal treatment by the state police. It was really
brutal.
Savage and brutal.
And honestly, it's been 500 plus years of mistreatment.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So.
And not just the Narragansett and the Nianticks and many peoples across the country.
It's most nations.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So this is a ubiquitous story. And I felt, well, okay, I could either not address it, or I could lean into it. And when I got here, that's exactly what I did.
Well, it's a really, really powerful film. Highly recommended.
I'm going to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard 3 times each weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square each week at the studios of Rhode Island PBS, where a remarkably talented crew takes great care of us, and we're grateful to them. I'm Jim Lutis, Executive Director of the Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy at Salve Regina University. If you want to catch up with me on Twitter, I'm at JM Lutis. My co-host is G. Wayne Miller, an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal and the author of 17 books. He's on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller, all one word. And our guest is documentary filmmaker Kendall Moore. She's on Twitter, too, at DocFilmProfRI. So DocFilmProfRI. Mm. So, Kendall, another one of your films is Sick Building. Mm. And that combines healthcare, medicine, and the environment.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about that film.
So the genesis of that story is interesting. I worked in that building that I ended up making a documentary about.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Did you know that it was a poison building?
Well, I didn't know when I moved into the building, but every day I would get a headache at the same time. So around 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I would start to get a headache and I would have to take some medicine. And then after a while, I thought, this is weird. Why do I get a headache every day? You know, and then on the weekends, I wouldn't get a headache. So I started to think, there's something maybe going on in this environment. Well, then some people were coming around. They found out I was a filmmaker. They found out I was interested in environmental issues. They started slipping me, as this probably happens to you as a journalist, information.
It does happen, yes.
I found out that there were cabinets full of complaints about the air quality in that building. So I first find out about the air quality, and then I dig a little bit more, and then I start to find out that it's not just the air quality. People are complaining about cancer, and it looks like maybe there's a cancer issue going on in this building. And so, long story short, I have literally hundreds of backstory interviews and then on-camera interviews, start to compile this documentary. It turns out that there's literally one floor where every person practically had cancer in a row, one office after another. And I thought, what is this? Is this a coincidence? So I released that film after I got tenure.
That was wise.
And I didn't do any promotion on it. I didn't talk about it to the press. And a lot of people have come to me and they said, thank you for telling this story, because it's not just this building, it's other buildings like it. And it turns out that Chafee wasn't an entirely unique situation in that it had PCBs in the caulking glue in the windows. They removed all of the windows, and presumably the building is fine now. But this PCB glue we're finding in schools all over the country now.
Wow.
It just happened to be that the Chafee building was one of the first that remediated for it.
So yeah. When you make a film like that, are you setting out simply to tell a story, or are you hoping to have some sort of greater societal impact?
You hope to have a greater impact. You don't know. I think it's kind of arrogant going into a project saying, I'm going to have an impact, or I'm going to make people know or understand. You don't know. You really have no idea.
So you concentrate on telling the story, and then the chips fall where they may.
I think actually it's not about just telling a story. It's about listening to the story being told to you. So I had to wait for people to emerge to bring me their stories at the their pace, not mine, because I would have just chewed through it immediately. But it took a long time for people to reveal their stories to me. I mean, that took over 5 years to get that story. So it's about listening, sitting, being patient, and listening. And then the impact, that has to be organic. You can't force impact. What happens, happens after it's released.
So another of your environmental films is Jalen and Joanna, a lead paint story. It's about a black mother and her now grown son who was exposed to lead paint as a young child and suffered the consequences. Mm-hmm. Let's have a look and listen to that.
I found out that I have suffered severe brain damage, and it gave me a learning, and I found out I have a learning disability, a developmental disability. I was a slow learner.
I moved into an apartment with my sister in Smith Hill, and that's when he was actually ingesting lead paint and touching lead dust, and then, you know, sucking on toys with lead dust.
Talk about the genesis of that story and the larger story that it tells in terms of lead paint. Mm-hmm. Not simply in where that film was shot, but again around this country.
Right, so on the heels of the Flint, Michigan story, I brought this topic to my students in my investigative documentary film class, and I said I really want to do a piece on lead, but I wanted to do a piece on lead here in the South Kingstown area and looking at the water, drinking water. Is there, you know, a corollary there between Flint? You know, maybe this is in our neighborhood. We didn't know. So we started investigating that, but something serendipitous happened. I was on the phone telling my friend, my colleague, Joanna, I'm working on this story about lead. And she said, oh, that's interesting. Did you know that my son had been poisoned at a very young age? And I said, I had no idea. And she said, do you want to meet him? And I said, I would love to meet him. So I sat down with her and him and soon learned that this had to be the story that I was going to tell. And then the story then pivoted towards paint chips, which Rhode Island, for some reason, has become, or at a time, you know, back in the day, let's say, the lead paint capital of the country. I mean, it's really significant problem.
And for people who don't know, what does lead poisoning do to people?
Oh, it could cause a multitude of issues, from cognitive to behavioral. It's a long list of things that happen to your body and your mind. And what was interesting in Jalen's case, there was some curiosity as to how he was presenting, because he was presenting almost like he was on the autism spectrum. Mm-hmm. So it can present in similar kinds of ways, cognitively and also behaviorally.
So lead paint certainly affects people regardless of race or color, but it disproportionately, the poisoning and the health effects that you document in your film, it disproportionately affects people and children of color. Why is that?
Poverty.
That is the simple answer, isn't it?
That is the simple answer. It's poverty and people not doing the right thing. Landlords not doing the right thing. The state not enforcing the law to have landlords clean up lead paint. So substandard housing, poverty, and not being willing to look out for communities of color, poor communities of color. That's really the simple answer of it.
And the flip side of poverty is certainly for some landlords, the rent, the money, it's a money operation. And so money to clean and is money out of their pockets. And it doesn't
matter. Exactly.
It's shameful.
Well, Joanna, it is shameful, but what's interesting in this case, and it ends up being a positive story, because Joanna ended up being an advocate, and she took the landlord to court, and she ended up winning. And it was one of the first cases of winning in this kind of way.
You shouldn't have to go to court to have your children be healthy. I mean, seriously, right?
Right, absolutely. Yeah.
So I'm curious, so you talked this, we've talked about some of your projects here. How do you decide what the next project you're going to have? Is it something that you see that inspires you, I've got to do this, or do you have an idea when you're looking for a new project that you want to do something about X?
That's so interesting. I think it's a combination of things, but for me, it has to hit me in my solar plexus. It has to hit me deep in my soul, because you could spend 5, 10 years, you could spend decades with a story. And I don't think that you can finish something unless you're really fully committed, not just intellectually committed, because there's a ton of stories where I'm like, this is a good idea, but it has to consume me in every way. Like, I have to wake up thinking about it, I have to go to sleep thinking about it.
It has to really obsess you.
It has to completely obsess me. And I have to almost fall in love with the people who I'm working with. So the people that I'm extracting stories from, I just feel a deep, profound love for those people. So I become committed to completing it because it's sort of like my love for these people and wanting to do something for them.
We have a lot of storytellers on this show, and in a common theme, whatever medium you're telling that story in, is what you just described. Mm-hmm. That passion, that I have to do it, it's consuming me. Well, and what a good thing, by the way.
In one of your films, The Good Radical, has been described as, and I'm quoting here, 37 minutes of poetry that explores the essence of love. Mm. So how did you come to make that film?
Again, the protagonist was a colleague of mine, Dr. Cynthia Hamilton. She was the head of Africana Studies at the University of Rhode Island. We had been friends for years, and she was one of the top Black intellectuals. I mean, she was up there with Cornel West and others. But unfortunately, she developed multiple sclerosis, and it eventually just consumed her body to the point where she couldn't be as active on the academic circuit. But she was on campus going to teach every day and still very active. But I just became so fascinated with her resilience and her tenacity and her commitment to just doing the everyday thing. And so it took me about 4 years to get up the courage to say, I'd really like to make a film about your life. I think more people need to know about you.
What'd
I was kind
say?
Of sheepish about it. I think at first she didn't realize what I meant, which was following her everywhere with a camera. And then it became her mother who was aged at that time in her 90s. She actually became the narrator. She became the storyteller.
Oh, how
because
cool.
Cynthia was just like, yeah, why are you telling a story about me? I'm typical. Don't tell the story about me. But eventually, yes, it became the story about her relationship with her and her mother, and it was just this incredible bond between the two of them. And I think it's a very beautiful story. It's a story that touches other people who have, walked their parents to the end of their life very intimately. And the change in me was significant from spending those many years with them. And I'm grateful to them what they did to me.
That's something we don't always talk about here, the effect that the story has on the storyteller.
On the storyteller. Yeah. We've got about 45 seconds left. What's next for you?
I'm working on several different projects. I'm working on a film looking at coping and resiliency within the autism spectrum community right now. I'm doing a couple of environmental pieces, Contaminants in the Bay. Yay. So still I'm working on documentaries that look at race and the environment and also the intersection between the two. And I'm really excited about
how do you keep all those different ideas going at the same time?
It's not easy. It's a lot of work, and I have a lot of students who are involved, and it's like herding cats. But I do. I've been doing it for a while, so somehow I just manage to keep it organized.
Well, it's a remarkable body of work. Kendall Moore, thank you so much for being with us.
She's
Kendall Moore. That is all the time we have today, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter, or else visit pellcenter.org. where you can also catch up on previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.